Thank you, Brother Pacius. Good morning, brethren.
Good morning.
If you weren't here last night, I'd like to send the love and greetings of the Chicago class once again, and especially my family. And I want to apologize for how I opened last night when I said, when you get old, it's harder to learn new songs. Your singing was lovely, even without the leadership of the B flat. Well, I think all of you feel the same way I do, that we live in a very fast-paced society. There doesn't seem to be enough time to do all the things you want to do in this life. And maybe it's been glamorized beyond reality, but at least the media would have you feel that there was a time when you could sit on your front porch with a glass of lemonade and talk to friends and neighbors about things, and life was just easy-paced and relaxed, and you knew your neighbors, and you liked your neighbors, and you did things with your neighbors. Well, like I said, that's, I'm sure, been glamorized more than it really is true. But it makes me think about friendship and the warmth of friendship and the relaxation of friendship. And when you talk about friendship, for us, it's a natural lead into fellowship and what it means to be brethren. In the Bible student world, we live in a time of splits and splintering into smaller and smaller groups. And in many cases, I think part of the problem is we don't know each other enough. We're not friends enough with one another. I can't help thinking that if we were better friends and we spent more time together in study and spiritual activities and sitting on the front porch with a glass of lemonade with our brethren, the tendency towards splits would be less than it is today. Certainly there have been doctrinal disagreements, some very important ones. But my opinion is that the majority of splits have come not particularly over doctrinal differences. We use a phrase called personality conflicts. Isn't that a terrible reason to have a split? Because you have a personality conflict with someone who's spirit begotten? I think that's a problem. And if we ever hear that phrase, it's probably never used by the ones who are doing the splitting. Used by others who describe those who may be splitting. I think we have a tendency when we're close friends to be less demanding that our friend dot every I and cross every T just the way we want them to. We seem to be a little bit more liberal with good friends, and I think that's important. This area involves, I believe, the discussion of the difference between agape love and filial love. You know, one brother in Chicago recently gave a talk on agape love, and he said that agape love seeks the eternal interest of the other person. It's considered the highest form of love because with agape love, you can do acts of love for someone without expecting something in return. It's a pure form of love. You're strictly doing it for the benefit of the other person without thinking that there might be something in it for you. God so agape'd the world that he gave his only begotten son. There was nothing mankind returned to God for his initial love to them. It's a love that doesn't seek self-interest. Filial love is different. Filial love is the love that family members have for one another. It's a love that is reciprocated. Listen to what Brother Russell says about it on reprint 3949. He says, "The noun that is the basis of the verb filial is frequently translated kiss in the New Testament. And by implication, the kiss belongs to the family. It implies a love that is more or less exclusive, not for everyone. It represents more of family love." Brethren, sometimes in our discussion of agape love, I think that we underestimate the importance of the filial love we're supposed to have for one another, that family love that Brother Russell spoke about. Vine's Dictionary describes filial as, I like this, tender affection. Notice this scriptural admonition about filial. This is Romans 12:10, and I'll read it from the Diaglot. It says, "With brotherly kindness towards each other, be tenderly affectionate, Philadelphia, in honor preferring one another." I get the impression that sometimes we think that it's enough to have agape love for the brethren without having a filial love for them. Jesus loved the scribes and Pharisees with agape love, didn't he? He died for them. But he didn't filio them. He didn't have a tender, warm affection for them because of wickedness. My contention, brethren, is that we as a fellowship need to seek harder both types of love. We shouldn't be satisfied that we can love one another in principle, this agape principle. We need to strive to have more tender affection one for another, and then progress to a love that is willing to even sacrifice itself in the interest of the brethren without return. That's Peter's counsel in 2 Peter 1:7. Remember where he's talking about the fruits of the Spirit? He says, add to your faith virtue, and to virtue knowledge. The last two things he says, add to your brotherly kindness love. He's saying, add agape love to your filial love that you should already have for one another. Filial is part of the progression that Peter tells us is the Christian path of growth. If all of the brethren had this filial love for one another, I'm convinced that the truth movement wouldn't be in the condition it's in today. Like I said, even though there have been some legitimate disagreements, personality conflicts should never be a reason. I'd like to look at an example of two people in the scriptures who I believe had a beautiful combination of filial and agape love for one another. You know, the friendship of Jonathan and David is one of the best examples in the scriptures of tender affection associated with a selfless, self-sacrificing love. They had an amazing friendship. And the more you read about it, the more you wish, boy, I wish I had friends like that more. And I believe the reason the Lord put this in the scriptures is because of how truly unique it was. Their relationship was full of tender affection in good times, and it was willing to sacrifice self under stress and trials. So lest we think that tender affection is strictly reserved for a brother-sister relationship, we're reminded here of how legitimate tender affection is between brothers and between sisters as well. So brothers, don't feel it's unmanly to have a tender affection for one of your other brothers, and sisters the same. The circumstances of life really tested the friendship of Jonathan and David beyond what most friendships could possibly endure. But the reason their friendship endured was because they never allowed outside pressures to drive them apart. Even when that outside pressure was from King Saul, Jonathan's father, the king of Israel, Jonathan would not betray David. In fact, he actively looked for ways of blessing him and helping him. Jonathan sometimes walked a fine line of balancing his loyalties because he had the same love for King Saul as he had for David. But when it came to Saul's hatred for David, Jonathan was able to discern the sins of his father and not allow his love for David to be compromised. Brethren, there is a lot we can learn from these men and what it means to be brethren in friendship and friends in the truth by looking at their relationship. As we look at their relationship, we're going to take a side trip, and we're going to see that the Lord may have intended their relationship to be a picture of the spiritual relationship between the ancient worthies and the church class. Well, in spite of the fact that we live in very different ages than the ancient worthies, and really the church has had virtually no physical contact except a little bit at the first advent, we really feel a kinship to them, don't we? We call Abraham our father in many ways, spiritually. In many ways, the ancient worthies are the forerunners of the church class. They fought spiritual battles long before we did, and you might say they paved the road on which others would someday follow spiritually. As part of this picture of kinship, we're going to read in 1 Samuel about three covenants that Jonathan and David made between themselves, which we believe detail our relationship with the ancient worthies. Well, let's start by looking at Jonathan a little bit. We know that he was the oldest son of King Saul. We know that he was a brave warrior, that he was courageous, and that he based his faith, his courage, on the fact that he knew that the Lord was with Israel. Being the son of King Saul, he was naturally the apparent heir to the throne of David, the throne of Israel. He was a natural leader of his men. If you read in 1 Samuel 13 and 14, his men were truly loyal to him. And you know, it takes a certain character to breed loyalty in other men. And Jonathan had that. They were loyal to him. You know, it's easy to be brave when you feel that there's someone behind you who's stronger than any foe in front of you. And that was Jonathan. He knew that the Lord behind him was stronger than any foe in front of him. And so his courage was there every time, almost every time. In 2 Samuel, the first chapter, verses 17 through 27, this is after Jonathan is already dead. David writes a eulogy about Jonathan and Saul. And it's been called by many scholars the Song of the Bow, probably because Jonathan was extremely skilled with the bow and arrow. This is what McClintock and Strong says about the Song of the Bow. It says, "It seems to have been sung in the education of the archers of Judah, in commemoration of the one great archer, Jonathan. He bade them teach the children of Judah the use of the bow." In 2 Samuel 1:23, this is what David says in that song. This is from Rotherhams. It says, "Saul and Jonathan, delightfully loving in their lives, even in their death, were not divided. Beyond eagles were they swift. Beyond lions were they strong." One of the greatest things that we know about Jonathan as a man, and it's maybe a little unusual, but he had a tremendous ability to love others and to express that love. You know, it wasn't an age where that was the in thing, men being tender and gentle. But here was a man who was a warrior and yet had this ability to show tender affection for others. David says that Saul and Jonathan were delightfully loving to each other. You know, we often remember Saul as a wicked king who went astray, who had to be rejected by the Heavenly Father. But I think that he was a good father to Jonathan. I think there was a close relationship between Saul and Jonathan. Jonathan didn't end his relationship with Saul when he saw Saul's wickedness or when he saw Saul's hatred for David. He didn't stop loving his father when his father threw a spear at him trying to kill him, because he defended David. Jonathan stuck with Saul in every battle they fought. And we're told that they were killed together with Jonathan's two younger brothers in the same battle. And so David says, even in death, they were not divided. Doesn't that go back to the character of loyalty? Even when the other person's not perfect, even when the other person has faults and sins, it's a character quality Jonathan had of being loyal even unto death. David goes on and says in verse 26, "I am distressed for thee, my brother Jonathan, delightful to me exceedingly. Wonderful was thy love to me, passing the love of women." Jonathan was the type of person who found it easy to love others, and that made him, obviously, an easier person to love. He would have been a good king of Israel, I believe, if God would have chosen him to do that. In his relationship with David, we see the same ease in which he entered relationships. Jonathan first meets David just after David slays Goliath, and Saul finishes questioning who this young boy is, this shepherd boy. Let's read 1 Samuel 18, verses 1 through 4. "And it came to pass, when he had made an end of speaking unto Saul, that the soul of Jonathan was knit with the soul of David. And Jonathan loved him as his own soul. And Saul took him that day and would let him go no more to his father's house. Then Jonathan and David made a covenant, because he loved him as his own soul. And Jonathan stripped himself of the robe that was upon him and gave it to David, and his garments even to his sword, and to his bow, and to his girdle." I like that. The soul of Jonathan was knit with the soul of David, and he loved him as his own soul. Brethren, here's the uniting of filial and agape love. Jonathan saw a brother in David right away. He didn't need to get to know him. He saw a common bond in the way David defended the Lord. Jonathan had been very brave in previous battles with the Philistines. It's rife throughout 1 Samuel. But this time, even Jonathan stands quietly as Goliath taunts Israel. For some reason, Jonathan couldn't quite muster the same strength he had mustered earlier, where he was willing to attack a huge garrison of the Philistines with a small band. But now he listens to the words of David, But first, listen to what Goliath says. This is amazing. 1 Samuel 17:10. He says, "I defy the armies of Israel this day. Give me a man that we may fight together." When Saul and all Israel heard those words of the Philistine, they were dismayed and greatly afraid. Jonathan was part of that. He was afraid of Goliath. It must have been an intimidating figure. But when he heard the words of David and saw David go out alone against the giant and strike him dead with his sling, Jonathan knew that he was a man of even greater faith than himself. What caused Jonathan to fear and to remain quiet motivated David to act and to speak for the Lord. Jonathan was at least 10 years older than David. At the time of this experience, it's felt that Jonathan was about 30 and David was about 20. It was a thrill for Jonathan to see a younger man have so much faith and such an incredible amount of courage. It was certainly a faith that had been born out of previous experiences. David told Saul that he had slain a lion and a bear in defense of his father's sheep, and he said that if the Lord had delivered him from those wild beasts, then he certainly would deliver him from Goliath. And that's how faith grows, brethren. As we experience the Lord's directions in our lives, we learn that he really is in control of things. He can help us slay the lions and the bears. As we continue to have trials and experiences in life, it becomes easier to know that he can help us overcome those because he's helped us with the lions and the bears. So when the Goliaths come along, it's not a new experience for us. There's a recollection of what he had previously done in our lives, and that recollection is what gives us the courage to face the Goliaths. I don't think Jonathan could have faced Goliath without the lions and the bears first. That was his strength of experience that gave him the strength for the greater trials ahead. Jonathan's faith seems to have faltered somewhat when it came to Goliath, but David never wavered. And isn't that what part of fellowship is all about? Isn't that why we need filial love for one another, because it's a love that keeps us together? When one of us is weak, we can gain strength from someone else who is stronger. When we see the strength in our brethren, it can inspire us to remind us how strong we can be if someone else can be that strong. That's how it should work in relationships, one drawing strength from another. In addition to that, I think we've all had the experience of seeing a really good quality in one of our brethren and saying, "Boy, I wish I had that quality in myself." And then you start thinking, "Why can't I? Why not copy that quality of patience, of servitude, of humility? I know I have a problem with that, but that brother doesn't, so I'm going to start copying it." And at first, it's a forced thing. You have to force yourself to do it. But the more you do it over and over again, it starts becoming a quality in yourself. That's what family is all about. Seeing the strengths in one and saying, "I'm going to copy that and I'm going to make it part of me." And eventually it does become part of you. That's how I believe the new creature's family life should be. Now, Jonathan and David were very similar in character. They were both naturally humble. They were honest and courageous and faithful. So when you have those things in common right from the start, the bond just, it's like opposites of a pole. You know, they just come together and they unite. On reprint 3232, Brother Russell says that those who would be the best friends need a third object in which both are interested. And that, like the radius of a circle, the nearer they come to the center, the nearer they approach to one another. Well, that illustration describes Jonathan and David to a T. Because the Lord was the center of their life. And as they worked towards the center, they were naturally coming together. We read in 1 Samuel 18:3 and 4, that Jonathan and David made a covenant of friendship with one another. And it was Jonathan who prompted the covenant. To seal the covenant, Jonathan takes off his robe, his armor, his sword, his girdle, and his famous bow and arrow, and he gives them to David. Why did Jonathan do that? What significance were those items to him? Well, you know, as a soldier, they were the most important temporal things that he owned. To Jonathan, they represented the honor and the power of Israel. To give them to David show that he considered David an equal, or one who deserved to represent Israel. In fact, it was almost an admission that David was a greater warrior than Jonathan. Well, you know, David now had two sets of armor. You remember after he killed Goliath, what did he do? He went and he took Goliath's armor, and he took it into his tent. That's in 1 Samuel 17:54. I think that was his way of wanting to remember how the Lord helped him through that event. Every time he looked at Goliath's armor for the rest of his life, he remembered how the Lord was in that whole experience. Well, now he has Jonathan's armor. It's another victory for David. Obviously very different. A victory over Jonathan's heart. We don't know if the Lord really intended the passing of the armor from Jonathan and David to be symbolic of something greater. But if it was, it certainly isn't hard to figure out what it might mean. Paul writes about the spiritual armor we use in our Christian warfare. He describes a new creature's armor as truth, justification, peace, hope, and the word of God, like the sword striking down arrows. Well, let's just look backwards a little bit. Let's jump ahead to the second covenant made between Jonathan and David. I think it helps to explain the whole concept of this passing on. The second covenant is found in 1 Samuel 20, verses 14 through 17. And in this covenant, Jonathan asked David to deal kindly with him and his family once David becomes king. Brother Russell comments on this covenant in reprint 1908. He says, though the gospel church will receive the first place of favor offered in the Abrahamic covenant, and the ancient worthies will find themselves next in honor, they will rejoice to have it so, because divine wisdom and love have so planned it. As David remembered his covenant with Jonathan not to cut off his kindness from the house of Jonathan, so the glorified church will remember its covenant to bless the ancient worthies first, and then all the families of the earth will be under their jurisdiction. Their loving ministry shall be held in everlasting remembrance. Well, brethren, if we take this future application of when the antitypical David is reigning and how he will remember the ancient worthies and bless them first, then it's easy to see how the passing on of the armor in the first covenant might picture the spiritual heritage that the ancient worthies pass on to the church class on this side of the veil. The fact that Jonathan was older and that he was a warrior before David was shows that the ancient worthies were in spiritual battles long before the church class. Paul reflects on their influence in our lives when he talks about the ancient worthies in Hebrews 12:1, and you can all quote it. Wherefore, seeing we are compassed about with so great a cloud of witnesses, let us lay aside every weight and the sin which doth so easily beset us, and let us run with patience the race that is set before us. We have those who did it before us, saying, with that example, you can do the same thing. Brethren, how many times have we marveled at the armor of faith that the ancient worthies wore? How many times have we looked at their hope and how it inspired them? They stood as an example to us of how truth can motivate us to be servants with our loins girded for service. Their example of having peace in very unsettling circumstances is one of their legacies. Remember the three Hebrews in the flames of fire. They weren't afraid. They weren't nervous. They accepted it with full peace, knowing that it was the Lord's will for them. And the ancient worthies wielded the sword of the Spirit, cutting down arrows before them. In so many ways, the lives of the ancient worthies were mirror images of the new creation. Every time we study them, we gain inspiration from them. We're antitypically receiving the armor that David received from Jonathan. Someday they're going to be brought back from the dead. And I know that the church will feel honored to bless those who have been such an inspiration to them. Another aspect of Jonathan's life that was significant was that he was the natural heir to the throne of Israel. But because of the unfaithfulness of his father, that honor was given to David. Jonathan never resented that because he saw the rightness of God's decision and he saw the goodness in David. What a character lesson for us there is in Jonathan. No jealousy, no desire to put David's honor down so that his honor could be elevated. You know, there's a French proverb that says, There is something in the misfortunes of even our best friends that is not wholly displeasing to our secret hearts. You know, in our fallen natures, there may be times when there's some truth in that. But in Jonathan, there was never even the slightest hint of it. He truly rejoiced that his friend was being elevated by God. That's what Paul meant when he said, in honor, preferring one another. Really preferring it. Not just saying it because it's the right thing and you're quoting the scripture. Jonathan preferred David to be king. Have you ever felt the slightest hint of jealousy of one of your brethren who was praised? Or someone says what a blessing they were, but no one says anything about you? Next time you feel that way, remember the legacy that Jonathan left for us of unselfish love. David received the throne of Israel, but I am just as thrilled at seeing Jonathan's reaction to that as anything else. You know, when we talk about the antitypical application of the ancient worthies playing a secondary role to the church class, as Jonathan did to David, we think of Hebrews 11, 39 and 40. It says, and these all, ancient worthies, having obtained a good report through faith, received not the promise, God having provided some better things for us, that they without us should not be made perfect. In 1 Samuel chapter 20, we have the setting of the second covenant made between Jonathan and David. You have to read that story, brethren, if you haven't done it for a while, because it is one of the most moving stories in the Bible. Let's read just a few sections and try to get the feeling of what was happening. In verse 1, we see David is hiding from the wrath of Saul, and he flees. He says to Jonathan, what have I done? What is mine iniquity? What is my sin before thy father that he seeketh my life? Jonathan tries to reassure him, just as a close friend would do, that because of his close relationship with Saul, Saul wouldn't do anything without telling him first. But David says, well, you are so close to your father. He says in verse 3, as surely as the Lord liveth, there is but a step between me and death. And then Jonathan answers very tenderly. He says, whatever your soul desires, David, I will even do it for you. Well, David wanted to know one thing. He wanted to know if Saul was really intending to kill him. And so he devises a test to determine Saul's intentions. David tells Jonathan that he's not going to eat at Saul's table for the next 3 days. And if Saul asks Jonathan where he's gone, tell him that he's gone to Bethlehem for a yearly celebration. And the test is to see what Saul's reaction would be to David's absence from his table. If he wasn't bothered by David's absence, then that would be a sign that David was safe. But if Saul became angry, then Jonathan would know that David's life was really in danger. In verse 8, David reminds Jonathan of the first covenant that they made together. Let me read the first part of that because it gives us a little insight into that first covenant. This is 1 Samuel 28, and I know we're jumping back to the first covenant, but the first covenant isn't exactly clear what it is until we get to this verse. It says, therefore, thou shalt deal kindly with thy servant, for thou hast brought thy servant into a covenant of the Lord with thee. Notice how David reveals that it was Jonathan's idea to make a covenant. Listen to Rotherham's for this verse. It says, into a covenant of Yahweh, that thou hast brought thy servant with thee. Now, into a covenant of Yahweh hast thou brought thy servant with thee. He's talking about the first covenant. He's saying the first covenant that was made between Jonathan and David on the one hand, and it was God on the other hand. Jonathan and David were partners in keeping a covenant with the Heavenly Father. We think it must have been a covenant that they made together, that as friends they were going to be loyal to the Heavenly Father. What a support they were for one another. What a picture of brotherhood they provide for anyone who wants to be faithful to the Lord. Brethren, we cannot walk the narrow way alone. None of us in this room, if we were left alone to travel the narrow way, could possibly be faithful. We need one another. We need the Jonathan at our side, reminding us that there's a covenant we made with the Lord that's vitally important to our lives. We need to lift our hands up with one another. If we were by ourselves, we just couldn't do it. the Lord works through our brethren in giving us strength and courage to commit ourselves to our covenant of sacrifice day after day. Jonathan agreed to the test that David proposed for Saul. And then Jonathan devised a way that he was going to signal this to David. And of course it involved the shooting of arrows. He said that after he found out what his father's intentions were, he would return to the wilderness where David was hiding, and he would shoot 3 arrows. And then he would send a young lad after the arrows, and David was to listen to Jonathan's commands. If he told the young lads that, well, the arrows are over here, then David would know that's a signal that it's safe. But if he shot the arrows way over David's head, it was a signal to David, you better go, because you're in danger. Follow those arrows and keep going. This discussion led to the second covenant made between Jonathan and David. It's found in verses 14 through 17 of 1 Samuel 20. This is Jonathan speaking to David. It says, "And thou shalt not only while yet I live show me the kindness of the Lord that I die not, but also thou shalt not cut off thy kindness from my house forever. No, not when the Lord hath cut off the enemies of David, every one from the face of the earth." So Jonathan made a covenant with the house of David, saying, "Let the Lord even require it at the hand of David's enemies." And Jonathan caused David to swear again, because he loved him, for he loved him as he loved his own soul. It's interesting that Jonathan should say these things at this point, when David's really at a low point in his life, when he's afraid of Saul's intentions, when he's depressed, and when he's hiding in the wilderness. He's showing David that, don't worry, this experience will pass. And he shows that he believed that he was speaking for the Lord when he said that David would be king. And then he asked David to make this covenant that David remember him and his house when David comes into his power. Isn't it amazing how Jonathan turns it around? They were really in opposite positions. Jonathan was the prince. David was hiding from fear. We see that David didn't hesitate to make that covenant to bless the house of Jonathan, because he saw in Jonathan a real friend, and he saw the devotion that Jonathan had to him. And I'm sure that we all feel the same way about brethren who have been loving and supporting to us over the years. We would never hesitate to return the blessing to them. I know, brethren, I feel a great indebtedness to brethren who have helped me and been a blessing to me in the narrow way. And I can certainly understand David's immediate reaction. Certainly I'll do that. That's the least I can do for you, is return the blessing. Antitypically, this corresponds to God's plan of having the younger bless the older. Psalms 45:16 talks about this when it says, "Instead of thy father shall be thy children, whom thou mayest make princes in all the earth." Just as the older Jonathan sought the blessing of David, so the ancient worthies will seek the blessings of the church class. A spiritual role reversal is shown in Psalms. The fathers becoming the children, and in turn the children are made princes in all the earth. After the death of Jonathan, David actively sought out family members that had been left of Jonathan. In 2 Samuel 4:4, we're told that Jonathan had a son named Mephibosheth. Well, David proved to be faithful to his covenant with Jonathan. Once he finds him, he brings him into his house, and he takes care of him the rest of his life. Mephibosheth is treated like a son. Well, a lesson we can gain from David here is that when a friend says he'll do something, he actually goes out and does it. We should be determined to get things done for our friends and our brethren. Even in small ways, brethren, we should be good to our word. When we say we're going to do something, we should do it. It's called integrity. It also is an indication that you respect the person you're talking to, and that you love them, and that you're willing to go the extra step and do what you said. And if there's some reason you can't do it, I think those things happen from time to time, then we should make the effort to explain the circumstances of why we couldn't do it. Do it ahead of time, before they wonder, how come you never did it? Have integrity in your lives and be faithful to your friends and brethren. Well, the last time that Jonathan and David saw each other, is given in 1 Samuel 23, verses 16 through 18. And this is where the third covenant is made. 1 Samuel 23, 16 through 18. And Jonathan, Saul's son, arose and went to David into the wood and strengthened his hand in God. And he said unto him, Fear not, for the hand of Saul my father shall not find thee, and thou shalt be king over Israel, and I shall be next unto thee, and that also Saul my father knoweth. And they two made a covenant before the Lord, and David abode in the woods, and Jonathan went into his house. Brethren, here again we see the combination of filial and agape love. The love of Jonathan shown for David. He encouraged David and pointed him to the promises of God that he truly was the anointed king of Israel. He assured him that Saul didn't have the power to kill him because this was God's decision to make David king. And Saul couldn't override that. The next covenant they made was that once David became king, Jonathan would be next under him. Brethren, this is one covenant that Jonathan couldn't keep, that David couldn't keep, because Jonathan was killed before David was crowned king. But he certainly would have, if he would have had the opportunity, if the Lord had chosen to allow Jonathan to remain. I think in a very literal way, Jonathan and David will be right next to one another when the kingdom on earth is established. I think that David may yet have the opportunity of fulfilling his covenant with Jonathan. In this interchange between Jonathan and David, we see another element that should be part of our relationships and fellowship together. There was a sensitivity to Jonathan, wasn't it? You could see it in everything that he says. He knew how David was feeling, and he made the effort to encourage him, but not with empty words. He encouraged him with the promises of God. Because those words have power. They're not just you trying to think of something nice to say. They are words with power. They are words that will be fulfilled by the Almighty God Himself. That's how you encourage your brethren. That's where your brethren can get strength, not just from what things you think are good, but from the very promises of God. Isn't it wonderful to see how a friend will defend a friend when he's being attacked? That's part of friendship. That's part of loyalty. Next time one of your brethren is attacked, don't be afraid to defend them. That same sensitivity that Jonathan had should be in all of us, brethren, as we encourage one another, as we see someone who's sitting alone, who's discouraged, as we see a single person who's kind of left out of the circle of the married, to be sensitive to those needs, to try to feel what they're feeling, and to bring them into the fellowship, to realize that it's nice to be in with the brethren who are in, but remember those who might be feeling a little left out. That's what Jonathan would have done. That's what he does right here. David's out in the wilderness all by himself. He seeks him. He goes after him. And he reassures him with the promises of God. And that gave David strength. Brethren, those promises are 10 times more, 100 times, 1,000 times more meaningful to us than they were the ancient worthies because we understand them more. We know the details more. We know just about everything that God is going to do. The ancient worthies saw things much more cloudy than we do. And so our encouragement with the promises should be that much clearer to one another. David was going to be the one who was going to overcome the enemies of Israel. So will the antitypical David. Brethren, you and I will have the privilege of reigning with Christ in removing all the enemies of the world of mankind. That is no small thing. That is a major thing. That is going to purify mankind. That is going to cleanse the earth of all the sickening and disgusting things the adversary has brought here. What a privilege for us to be part of that, and how we should use that to encourage one another. You know, when we see things in the larger context of God's plan, it gives us courage, doesn't it? And it gives us something to really rejoice about, even during discouraging experiences. It's easier to rejoice when you know that there's someone who cares about you. And that's the relationship here. Jonathan was lifted up because he saw genuine love and concern. David was lifted up because he saw genuine love and concern from Jonathan. That's what family is all about. And that's how God wants us to treat one another. In verse 23, Jonathan reaffirms his conviction to David.
He says, as touching the matter which thou and I have spoken of, behold, the Lord be between thee and me forever. It's our common bond too, isn't it, brethren? It's the Lord who's between us. None of us would even know each other if it wasn't for the truth and the common bond that brings us together with. That bond is going to be there forever. It's not just this lifetime. The common bond you and I have with the Lord and with each other is an eternal thing. And we should think of it in the broader context. In the story of Jonathan and David, we see a beautiful oneness. We see a unity of spirit that we certainly would do well to copy. Wouldn't you like to have 100 friends like Jonathan or David? I certainly would. They were there for each other. They supported and they encouraged one another. They pointed each other to God just as they came to the center of the circle. And they didn't look for faults in one another. Jonathan was like an older brother to David, but a brother who felt no sibling rivalry, one who was just as happy to see David blessed, even if it cost him something. Brethren, can you picture the time when that type of spirit will be in every person in the world? What a bond of unity that mankind will have with one another when they are all Jonathans and Davids. Only God's Spirit can create that type of heart. His Spirit today is working in only a small percentage of people. Brethren, if we want to be part of that small percentage, we will show the evidence and the fruitage, and by the way we love one another. May the Lord add his blessings.